On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the cloud gets busted, your DNS gets poisoned, and your network has eyes. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for the following show is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 15, recorded October 22nd, 2012. Streaming with the Fishes. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech was brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second one free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And social media solutions from SAP. If you're a social media manager at a large enterprise, gain insight and engage in social media in a systematic way with social media solutions from SAP. Learn more at sap.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a fantastic panel, starting with the ever-present Mr. Brian Chi. That's right, the geek in paradise, the geek on the peak of the volcano. Brian, how is Hawaii?
It's boring, you know, it's paradise, you know, nothing changes. It's great.
Nothing changes in paradise. And speaking of nothing changes, yeah, we've got a lawyer on. No, seriously, no. Mr. William Shapiro. William, you're from williamshapirolaw.com. You are a lawyer, a legal representative in San Francisco, California. Thank you very much for joining us. How is it sunny? Is it rainy? Is it snowing in San Francisco?
Thanks for having me. It's actually turning out to be a beautiful day. And hopefully the rain will hold off so the Giants can get in Game 7.
I like it. A Giants fan. I did not know that. And you know what? I love you all the more for it. Now, let's get straight into this first story because it's actually a little scary. That's right. Over the last week, we had a Supreme Court in North Carolina make a decision that has ramifications for all of the enterprise, all of business. In fact, for everyone who does anything on the internet. It was a case called Jennings versus Jennings, which started as a very messy civil case. It was a divorce, and divorces are always messy. But in this particular case, you had the, I believe it was the daughter-in-law of the wife who social engineered her way into the email account of the husband to prove that he was committing adultery, and that was used in court. Well, the husband argued that she can't do that. Under the Stored Communications Act, she was forbidden from accessing his online emails. Well, the court has decided that, no, that's not the case because the SCA protects information that's temporarily stored. So, for example, in a router or being handed off to another server, it protects information that has not yet been looked at. So say an email that has been unread. It also protects information that has been deliberately backed up. But in this case, because he had read the email and left it on the server, it was essentially abandoned. Therefore, it wasn't a backup and it wasn't protected under the SCA. I want to toss this to you first, Bill. This could have a major chilling effect, could it not? I mean, with all of our information up in the cloud, if this stands, it basically means the police can look at anything.
Well, I just want to start by saying it's a state case. It applies directly in South Carolina, which is where the case came out of, and it's a state-only case. It's not a federal case. There's a conflict between what the Ninth Circuit has said and what some of the other courts are saying around the country. The reason for this is the way that the judges are reading the statute. The statute says that there has to be two things in order for the information to be protected. And if you read them separately, you get one result. If you read them together, you go down the path that gets you to the Jennings case. In what the Ninth Circuit has said is, if it's up there and it's as long as it is needed to be up there, then you're going to then it's going to be protected because we're going to consider it a backup, especially if it's been if it's an email. What the Jennings court said was, well, we understand that the Ninth Circuit said this, but if you look at the requirements, that it has to be a temporary, immediate, and incidental copy, and the storage is for backup purposes only, then the courts are starting. Then the South Carolina court is saying, really, it's not protected by the Storage Communications Act. Now, that's different because the Ninth Circuit effectively created its own version of how to read the statute, and what that did was it increased the protection in a law that was written back in 1986. Now, what really should happen is somebody in Congress should amend this, but the problem is until then, we're kind of left with a patchwork of in some places you're going to be protected and in some places you're not going to be protected.
Yeah. T-Bert, break this down for me on the network side. So you and I have been making a big push into the cloud. We want our data in the cloud. We want our services in the cloud. But that's all predicated on this idea that the things in the cloud are going to be private. They're going to be kept safe. What happens if the law starts allowing public institutions, law enforcement, or even private institutions to get into our data because it's in the cloud? It's not a backup. It's not something protected under the SCA from 1986.
Basically, read final rights for cloud anything. If you can't have, say, I guess I'll call it the embassy effect. If the cloud cannot be viewed as an extension of the corporation, cloud's dead. You just read it last rights. That's my view.
Right. Yeah, exactly. If you can't trust that the data that you put in an anonymous colo is going to be safe, then, of course, your only alternative is to put it into a dedicated colo, something that you actually own that you can push your property rights upon. Now, Bill, what are the chances that this is going to stand up to scrutiny when this gets passed up to, say, the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, this case is not going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. There's a federal question in it, but it's unlikely that the Supreme Court would take this. But this is not the only case that's out there that comes up with a different reading from the Ninth Circuit. There's a case out of Oregon from a couple of years ago. And in that case, they said, well, really, the SCA isn't so important because we believe that under our state's constitution, you've got your Fourth Amendment protections in the cloud just as if you had them, just as if it was a piece of paper in your desk drawer. So, you know, as far as whether this is going to go up or not, I doubt that it's going to go to the Supreme Court. It does have a federal question, but it's very unlikely that it's going to happen. But what's going to happen is different judges in different states who are going to be looking at the law, not so much the technology, are going to say, well, which way do we go? Do we go with this expansive reading that the Ninth Circuit gave it, which really doesn't track with the statute and seems to conflict with it, but comes up with the right decision from a user standpoint, as opposed to the South Carolina version where they say, look at the law. The law itself is flawed, and that's actually what the concurrence says, that there needs to be a change to the law and that the court should not be legislating the law. So really, you're going to have a patchwork for a while until either Congress or the Supreme Court gets it, and it's going to come out of one of the other circuits probably, and it's going to be a collision between the Ninth Circuit, which tends to get overruled, and another circuit which may be more favored by the Supreme Court.
So in that scenario, it's really going to come down to states' rights. Individual states will be able to set policy depending on their interpretation of this law and, well, basically the Fourth Amendment.
Until then, yeah, exactly. It's going to, you know, you're going to see states like California, which is under the Ninth Circuit's regime, and Oregon, which has said, look, you don't even need to get to the Ninth Circuit question, but we think that our state constitution handles this. And those are going to be places where your data is going to be safer. But if you're just talking about accessing it like in the Jennings case, then you're talking about a situation where it's going to be up to your state's courts as to whether or not the access is going to be a violation of the SCA or your own state's constitution.
Okay. Now, Chibert, what is this going to do for these corporations that have data centers in different parts of the country? Apple. Let's take Apple. Apple has data centers in California, and they're building a huge one in this state, in North Carolina. Do they now need to worry? I mean, as you said, if there is no privacy, the cloud is dead. Well, if each state gets to determine how far the SCA reaches and how broad it can be interpreted, then it's going to scare away people from making a data center in a state that's not privacy-friendly, right?
Oh, you bet. And actually, the question isn't state by state. It's actually country by country. Because remember, a lot of these cloud services, especially Amazon and Google, cache their files all over the world because it's a feature. You want to be able to make sure you have backups no matter what happens. You know, if there's a natural disaster in one state, you want to be able to go and, you know, still make those files available. It's all part of a service level agreement. But if a state starts saying, well, your cloud storage is open to scrutiny and, you know, I can do go crazy, you know, basically it's open for public, you know, go crazy with it and not require things like the discovery process, whatever the law says on doing things. If they consider it abandoned material, I see, you know, data centers in those states just going poof, you know, it's just not going to happen. And all this construction, all this employment and so forth is going to go away. So I'm seeing this is going to have a lot wider reaching effects than many people think.
Bill, I want to go back to you because there seems to be a question in the chat room. Remember, we're a bunch of tech people, not necessarily a bunch of law people. There's sure. A question about what's this thing with the circuits? I mean, when you start talking about circuit courts, how does that progress? Can you try your case in multiple circuits, or is there a specific circuit that deals with, South Carolina's case? How does that work?
Okay. America, the United States has a federal system, which means there's every state has its own court system. And then the federal government has their own court system. And they're separate, and they deal with different types of cases, but there's also an overlap. In order to be in a federal court, you either have to have a federal question, meaning there's got to be a constitutional right at issue, a federal law at issue, or what we call diversity jurisdiction. Now, what's going on in this case is we have a state court interpreting a federal law. Conceivably, this case could have been brought as a case in federal court, but they chose to bring it in state court, probably because there were some other components that didn't get taken up on appeal. So you have state courts that can interpret federal law, but they're really supposed to give deference to federal courts ruling on federal cases. Just in the same way that federal courts are supposed to give deference to state courts that have ruled on state-only issues. So you've got these two systems, and you can't bring the same case in both, but you can bring at the same time, but you can bring one in a state court if you think it's more advantageous to you, or you can bring one in the same issue up in federal court as long as there's a federal issue in it because you think it might be more advantageous to have it heard there.
Right.
So I hope that clears that up a little bit.
Yeah. We've got a good question from Lawn Dog in the chat room who asks, what does the term abandoned material mean, abandoned content? Is there any definition? And I believe in this case, that's the problem. They're essentially saying that the SCA only refers to data that it's being stored. So they define being stored as being backed up or being transferred from one device to the next, so that temporary cache. They say that if something's being stored for you to read, so for example, an email message that you have not yet read off of Gmail, it is protected. But if you read it and you left it on the server and you didn't try to back it up, then they consider that abandoned. And that's actually the logic that they use to allow this case to proceed, to go for the defendant, to say, look, you left the email on your email server, therefore it was not protected under the SCA. Bill, I want to throw this back to you, let you have the last word on it. And that is, when we start to look at this case, is this really just about a divorce case? Can we just say, look, they're not going to use this as a precedent because it was helping within the confines of one specific case that really didn't deal with tech? Or is this something that needs to be seriously looked at by legal tech pundits?
I think this is something that does need to be looked at by tech pundits, mostly because what you're talking about is when is storage, when is backup, and as we're moving things more and more onto the cloud and less onto your own storage devices at your own home or your own office, then you're talking about, well, what is actually protected? And in the something you mentioned before about abandon, really in the SCA, there's a the split comes at 180 days. 180 days and out, the level of protection goes down significantly. 180 days and less, and then open, you still have a lot of protection. And then you have sort of this intermediate zone of protection at less than 180 days and with it being opened. The question really needs to be answered is whether or not we're going to say that we're extending, you know, our control over our information into the cloud, or if what we're saying is once it's in the cloud, it's just public and anybody can grab it if they want.
Right. And as Chiebert mentioned, if that's the case, then basically all online services go away. No one's going to trust the cloud if they even remotely think that people will be able to spy on them, if we don't have that guarantee of privacy.
Exactly.
Well, this is not done. I mean, I'm sure we're going to hear about this in the coming months, and we will definitely hear about it the first time that this case is used as a precedent. And William, at that time, can I invite you back and get more of your analysis on what the SCA does and how it's going to affect us in the tech community?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
And I know you have things to do. I want to thank you very much for coming on. Before you go, is there anything that you'd like our viewers, our listeners to know about?
Other than the tune in for Game 7 tonight, it should be a good one. I just wanted to thank you for letting me come on.
Fantastic. That's William Shapiro from WilliamShapiroLaw.com. William, thank you very much, and go Giants.
Thank you.
Now, Chiebert, now that it's just the two of us, I mean, this is it just me, or, I mean, is this really scary?
Oh, man. You know, when you started talking about this, and I remember the press releases that I've heard on this, it's like, wow, what stuff do I absolutely have to move out of the cloud now? Because
right.
Then, you know, I'm writing books. Does that mean that the stuff that I've been working on and hasn't, quote, been backed up, does that mean my book is now open fodder? This is really scary stuff. And even if I put encrypted files up there, that, you know, depending on how you interpret that law, that, you know, encrypted files doesn't even protect my rights.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I think William is right in that this is probably not going to make its way up to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, at least not immediately. But it does seem to be a question that needs to be answered, because if you've got the states able to make their own interpretation of the SCA and what is protected and what isn't, well, it doesn't make sense, because the internet runs through every state. It runs through all jurisdictions. And what if the law in one jurisdiction doesn't match the privacy policies in another? Well, who wins? What happens? And again, I think that's the chilling effect. That tells enterprises, there's no way I'm going to put my accounting information on a server that could be read by my competitor. And there's no way I'm going to put my email, my corporate email, on a server in the cloud if it means law enforcement can look at it without a warrant. Personally, for you as an administrator at a research center at a university, what do you see this having real-world effects on you and your work?
Well, my researchers have already stated flat out that they won't use Google Mail for a lot of their research email, because once a lot of research, you know, any kind of research material gets out of the country, it's considered published, and which means that kills PhD papers, it kills a lot of research grants and things like that. So they're already gun shy as it is. Personally, I think it's time for the tech community to start writing their congressional delegation and say, we need an embassy effect for our data in the cloud. The cloud needs to be considered an extension of the corporation, and that extension of the corporation needs to have all the rights and properties of being on my property. It should be considered just like an embassy, foreign soil.
Right, exactly. We saw this huge groundswell, this upswell support for stopping SOPA and PIPA. This could actually be more damaging. I mean, and this is one of those stealth cases, because no one's hearing that much about it. I really want to hear more about this in the news as we go on, because it affects the way that we communicate. It's going to affect the way that we use the internet. It's going to affect the way that we use the cloud. That's just not acceptable. But you know what is acceptable, Chiebert?
I don't know, Padre. What is it?
It's GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. That's right. They are our first sponsor, and they're with us still here at This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this is how it works. This is the philosophy behind it. They know that we need to meet. It's how we work. It's how humans work. We want to be face-to-face. We want to gather together with the people that we work with our team, with our colleagues, with our coworkers. The problem is, even though that is a very effective way to get work done, it's a very effective way to keep your team focused, you can't be everywhere. And if you could be everywhere, your team members couldn't be everywhere at the same time. Now, you've got a couple of choices. You could stop all the work. You could have scheduled times where everyone gathers together, flies in, drives in, whatever. Or you could try something like GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. This is how it works. Let's say you're in a building and you've got workers on multiple floors or multiple buildings across a city or multiple cities across the country or multiple countries across the world. Well, using GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix, you could be everywhere, anywhere, on any device, a PC, a Mac, a tablet, your phone, and with one click, be there, be in the meeting, see your colleagues, see your coworkers, see your teammates, and be as if you are sitting in the same room. With HD video, you get to see the expressions on your coworkers' faces. And with their easy scheduling calendar, it means that a few clicks means that you can set up a meeting with up to 26 people with a minimum amount of fuss. GoToMeeting really is that simple. Now, just a few weeks ago, I had a meeting with some of my colleagues who, were all around the world. It was just going to be a teleconference call, but I suggested GoToMeeting. Now, they groaned. They didn't want to use it because they figured, here's another piece of tech that we're going to have to learn. It's going to be complicated. We're going to need tech people in each room. But believe it or not, I was able to guide everyone who was in the meeting into having it installed on either their PC, their Mac, or their tablet within a matter of minutes. And we had the advantage of being able to share documents, see one another on our HD screens, and chat back and forth. It was a fantastic way to explain to people that, look, if you can make a phone call, if you can send an email, you can use GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit GoToMeeting. I want you to try it free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button and use promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Chibert, both of us just came back from InterUp in New York, right?
Oh, yeah. Lots of fun.
Lots of fun. And we've both been around long enough to know that when we used to turn on our range, what was it, a Class A, a couple of Class Bs, a couple of Class Cs, we would bombarded. Do you remember what was the high water mark for that when we first turned it on? How much junk came down the pipe?
Yeah, the second we turned on BGP peering, the high water mark, immediately 7 meg of junk started hitting us just from bot traffic.
And that was before anyone actually was actively scanning for us. That was just the stuff that was randomly hitting our IP addresses.
Oh, yeah. I think I want to say it at one time before we got all the ACLs put in place. I think we were up to about 15 or 20 meg.
Right. And that's a lot just for having, a range up and active. Now, I think it's gone down since then, and I know it's gone down for us because we now block everything upstream. We have really good relationships with our ISP, and we're able to get them to stop all that traffic before it gets to us on the show floor. But we had a chit-chat with some of the guys who were part of the InterOp team from Dyn DNS, and they explained to us a different kind of attack.
Hello, this is Corey von Wallenstein from Dyn Inc. I'm the head of the product team, joined here with Kevin Gray, our technology integrator. And we're here at InterOpNet to share some very interesting lessons on what we can do to prevent DNS cache poisoning attacks, what we did for InterOpNet to fix the cache poisoning attacks and avoid them altogether, and what you can do for yourselves to avoid becoming a victim of a cache poisoning attack. So at a very high level, a cache poisoning attack is an attacker taking control of what answers your DNS servers give and what answers your users receive. And it ultimately involves your users getting connected to the wrong servers, to an attacker's servers. So if your user was trying to get to mybank.com, they are effectively routed to mybank.com as a website that would appear in their address bar, but it would actually be pointing to an attacker's computer, and the user would be directly connected to the attacker's computer. And now I'd like to introduce Kevin, who's going to go into a little bit of the details of DNSSEC and how that's effective to combat cache poisoning attacks and show what we did for InteropNet. Kevin?
So this year for InteROp, we provide DNSSEC, which is the way of preventing a DNS cache poisoning attack. DNS cache poisoning, as Corey alluded to, is essentially when the recursive DNS server goes out to ask, I need this address, mybank.com. It goes out to root and says, do you have this address? Root replies back, says, no, I don't have this address, but I do have the .com address. So your recursive server takes that .com address, goes out to it and says, .com, do you have mybank.com address? It comes back and says, no, I don't have mybank.com address, but I do have my bank address. If it's you, then you can go out to to the actual mybank.com, and it'll return back the address. DNS cache poisoning comes from someone sitting in between and just replying back to your recursive server saying, mybank.com is here. Mybank.com is here with a bad address. So what happens is a race condition occurs, and the bad address gets in before the good address is returned back, and then the bad address is passed on to your machine. The way DNSSEC works to prevent that is it validates each response along this chain of asking. So when you go out to root, root would say, no, I don't have mybank.com, but I do have .com. And here's what's called a DS key, which is a public key that you can then use to decrypt an encrypted zone. Say, here's the DS key for that zone. Then when you go to com to ask for it, com will give you back the fully signed zone with the encrypted key using their private key. You decrypt it with that public key to verify that it's correct. If someone tries to inject themselves and poison the cache, so to speak, then that decryption would fail and you would know, oh, I've got a bad response back, and throw it out. So we've done that for the first time here at interop.net, fully signed, both board and reverse zones all the way through, using our Dynec tool. The Dynec tool makes it relatively easy, wraps up the DNS signing into one click versus having to go through a number of steps you normally would in creating the keys and signing the zones. So that's pretty much what we're providing here and the way it's going to stop you from getting a DNS poison cache attack.
Chiebert, it's one of those pro secrets that DNS is the least secure part of the internet. It's the least secure part of the network that we all use. It's of the cloud. Why do you think it is that the vulnerability in DNS isn't that publicized?
It's one of the dirty little secrets. The industry doesn't want to air its dirty laundry. So DNSSEC is unfortunately been very, very slow to be adopted. And I think a lot of it's because not every DNS manager is that sophisticated. You know, sometimes they're just running, little scripts and things like that. You know, they're doing things mechanically. So I'm going to put a plug in for Cricket Lou, who's agreed to be on the show someday in the future. He's got the next version of the DNS and bind book from O'Reilly Press coming out someday, perhaps early to mid next year. I don't know. But he's definitely putting a section of DNSSEC in there. So I'm a big book learner, and I'm hoping a lot of other people are, because DNSSEC isn't that hard. There's just a lot of moving parts that you have to play with. And maybe if there's a book out on the topic, we'll start seeing more people doing DNSSEC.
Right. I think you're right there. I think DNS, it's kind of a black box for a lot, many enterprises that I've worked with will just get a DNS appliance and they'll get an engineer to come out, but their in-house people actually don't really know how to properly configure their DNS to be secure. And we've seen it. I mean, it doesn't have to be an attack, although we have seen DNS cache poisoning attacks. I think the biggest one was a few years back, Iran tried to get rid of YouTube, and the way that they did it was they poisoned the cache. They thought they were just poisoning it within Iran, but it ended up going around the world. And so for, 15 minutes, the entire world pointed to Iran to try to get to YouTube. That's interesting on so many different levels. The first, which is they shouldn't have been using DNS to try to do an administrative shutdown of a website. And the second thing is that they didn't realize that they'd be wiping off YouTube across the planet, but I'm sure it raised a few eyebrows when they realized they could.
But we got a denial of service attack against Iran by accident, right?
Right, exactly. That's just how it works. Now, when we start looking at DNSSEC and when we start looking at implementing it within the enterprise, aside from the barrier of just not really wanting to expend resources, what do you think is the number one thing that will keep it from being adopted quickly now that it's a standard?
Ignorance. The problem is an awful lot of people use the DNS within Active Directory. And while DNSSEC exists in that implementation, finding the widgets to turn it on and off and configure it is not real evident. So I think Microsoft needs to do a little bit better job on putting out some white papers. The white papers exist. I found it once, but the second time I tried to find it, it took me an hour to find it again. So maybe there needs to be a few more highlights on how to get to those white papers, because it's there, just hard to find.
We've got a few interesting comments in the chat room. One of them is from Laser, and he's wondering if Google's DNS server is protected. And I guess we could add a couple of that. For example, is OpenDNS server, is that protected from these kind of cache poisoning attacks?
OpenDNS is following a lot of the standards. OpenDNS is based on DNS in bind, so it's not that much difference. And DNS in bind is where you will where basically DNSSEC existed first. Because it's open source, the developers didn't have to pay any royalties. And so thusly, a lot of prototypes ended up in DNS in bind before the commercial products. The nice thing is a lot of the DNS appliances are actually based upon the work in the Linux and BSD world. So once the modules are available and vetted and debugged, we should see it circle the globe very, very quickly.
Now, let's give a little bit of knowledge for the people watching us right now who may be running just their own home enterprise or their home network. Would you ever suggest that a Comcast user or, say, a Verizon user uses the Verizon or Comcast DNS server?
Oh, man. You know, I've had to deal with Comcast when I was doing stuff for Oliver and also for Kurt. And some of the things that they do are just plain evil. They've gotten better, but, you know, the fact that they do a lot of port blocking, a lot of traffic shaping, capping and things like that is just, you know, in my mind, just plain evil. But the fastest DNS is always going to be the DNS closest to you. But there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to go and, say, set up your secondary DNS somewhere else. Now, depending on where you are in the country, some of the ISPs actually prevent you from doing that. They actually block DNS queries other than to their own. I would say use the NS lookup tool and then issue the server command and then the IP address of some other DNS. If it connects and it allows you to do a DNS lookup, then your ISP isn't blocking it, and you can use that as your secondary. If it comes back and say server cannot be contacted, then maybe your ISP is being evil.
We've had a minor freak out in the chat room with Eric in Michigan and Curtis B. And they're right. It's a pointed question. It's a very unique question that doesn't really have a good answer. But I think that actually would be a really good episode for a future data closet. How to either run your own, roll your own, or custom set your DNS settings to make sure that you don't get caught up in, let's just say, network shenanigans. Now, DNS is all about connecting us to where we need to go. It's about resolving the addresses on the internet so that our computers, our clients, know which servers to connect to. And we like to stay connected. I mean, we are an IPTV network. And that's why when we built this new studio, we decided that we wanted our phone system to be advanced as, well, the studio itself. So when we built the studio, we decided to put our phone system in the cloud. We didn't want an expensive, bulky, noisy, difficult to configure PBX system in the basement. And so what we did was we talked to our IT guy, Russell. And Russell said, look, there's a service right now that will let you have all the features of a PBX, but well, keep it in the cloud. Keep it easy to manage. And that's why we went with RingCentral. RingCentral is your phone system in the cloud. There are zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail in their email, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. It's really a no-brainer. Here's what we would like you to do. We want you to have as good of an experience of getting a phone system as we had when we built Twit. RingCentral offers an all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer just for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. They even created a number for you. You can call 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can also go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's RingCentral, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, we're going to get to the meat of the episode, and that is all about network cameras. Chibert, we've been playing with network cameras quite a bit. In fact, you've got them deployed everywhere. Tell me, on a physical plant like a university campus, where do you see the most use for network cameras?
Actually, it's usually being driven by the safety component of any campus. All it takes is one attack or one robbery or purse snatching or something, and all of a sudden the community is all up in arms, and you start getting parents, you start getting all kinds of people calling for increased safety. Now, one of the things that has happened at the University of Hawaii campus, we've got all these cameras going in, but we ran into an unintended consequence. Everybody's trying to save energy, save energy, save energy. So a lot of our outdoor lights have been changed to those horrible orange high-pressure sodium lamps to save energy. Well, the problem with orange light is it just flattens everything out. You lose a lot of contrast. We had a case where someone actually broke into a lab, stole an iMac, and we actually could track this person walking across campus. We actually got a full face shot as he was coming out of an elevator, but the contrast was so low and the frame rate on the camera in order to compensate for the light was so low that even using something like the image enhancement software from salientstills.com, I wasn't able to bring up enough detail. So shout out to Laura Teodizio and her company. She's a colleague of mine from MIT. She actually created this software where you can actually take frames from a video, both before and after the frame that you want, and it'll actually create additional resolution just by overlaying the frames with a slight offset from the movement, and you can create a much, much higher resolution image. A lot of law enforcement use this for things like license plate enhancement and things like that. This is what you would see in CSI.
Right. The ever-present TV trick that they have where they can take a grainy still photo from a digital camera and blow it up until there's only one pixel and still you can see exactly what's going on. Basically, that's the kind of software that you're talking about.
You bet.
Okay. Now, we have played with a lot of network cameras at Interop. It's one of the things that was sort of on the cutting edge for a while. High resolution, HD video, audio capabilities, all PoE cameras that you could deploy around the show floor. And it was for a variety of reasons. It was for security, to make sure that no one broke into any of our racks, any of our pedestals. But it was also because we wanted people to realize, look, this is technology that is reachable. It's attainable right now. If you want to, you can play with any of this gear. A few of the items that we look for in every network camera, if you go to the camera shot right here, is stuff like this. So this is a 212 PTZ from Axis Communications. It's one of the sponsors of Interop. And what you see inside here is this is a PTZ camera, but it's solid state. It's PoE, so I only need one connection, which provides both the data and the power. And it has a large enough resolution in its CCD sensor so that this fisheye lens can see almost 180 degrees around the camera. And I get to digitally zoom in to each individual part. It's a really cool system, but I believe you've played with mechanical PTZ cameras and you find them superior, right?
Well, it's just a matter of, you know, when you're dealing with fisheye, you're having to deal with de-fisheyeing or de-skewing the video electronically, which is all fine and good, but you do get some artifacts in there. Mechanical tilt, pan, and zoom also has the advantage that you can put some really sexy lenses on those. So I've actually used some mechanical tilt pan and zooms at airports so that the tower can actually drive the camera around and actually inspect planes as they fly by. You know, that like in some of those disaster movies. Hey, is my landing gear down? Well, with a 40x lens, they can watch it come through. It's kind of a neat thing.
Right. One of the other concerns that we've had with PTZs in the past is with network cameras in general, the law hasn't quite caught up with technology, especially in terms of surveillance. You can look at a country like England, which has the most cameras per person ever. I mean, it's a surveillance state, and their law is kind of caught up. They've altered it. They've modified it so that people just know if you're going to be out in the street, you're going to be on camera somewhere. But here in the States, we still have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And now that it's so easy for me to take a camera and drop it into my warehouse or drop it into the front of my abode, drop it into my office, there's that sort of gray area on what's legal and illegal to film, store, and maintain. How do you deal with that on a university campus? I mean, you're dealing with students.
Well, I have an advantage because we are a public university. So as such, public spaces have been declared at the state Supreme Court level to have no expectation of privacy. So as long as I go and post that video surveillance is taking place and I make really sure that the video camera has no possible way of seeing into a private space, especially things like bathrooms, private offices, that kind of thing, I'm in reasonably good shape. Unfortunately, this changes on a state-by-state basis. Hawaii is one of those states where it's a single-party state. Only one party has to consent to recording, like in wiretapping and so forth. That is definitely not the case in states like California or New York or whatever. So it's something you have to look at on a state-by-state or even a county-by-county basis.
Right. I want to switch gears a tiny bit and just talk about the range of technology that we're talking about when we're talking about network cameras. Again, this is a 212 PTZ from Axis. This is, even though this is a bit old, this is still a bit on the higher end. I mean, this can run you between $1,000 and $2,000 for the new versions of this. And yes, they're very good. They're very high resolution. They've been designed to be mostly bulletproof. But then we've got things like this. This is a drop cam. This is something that we've been using here at Twitch Studios since the beginning of the studio. And this is actually not that bad when compared to this. This actually has a higher resolution than this Axis network camera. In fact, Jason just pulled it up right now. It's a fantastic service, not just a product, but a service. It allows people to have a very low barrier to entry if they want to have surveillance across their business, across their enterprise. You basically set up a bunch of these cameras. They're all wireless. This is only for power, this power cable here. And it allows you to record to a DVR up in the cloud. Now, the nice thing about this is the camera itself costs, I believe, $150. But then a year of service costs you $100 plus an additional, I think it's $50 per every camera that you add on. It's, some people think that this is the consumer level. But I've seen these deployed in enterprise situations. What are we seeing here? I mean, if this is going to cost 10 to 20 times more than this, and this requires me to host my own server, host my own network infrastructure, where are we going to see a melding of these two services, these two offerings, these two technologies? Jibber?
Well, there's an awful lot of webcams out there. Everybody says, oh, I can buy a $20 webcam at Costco or Sam's Club. And it's like, yeah, fine. But when you start really looking at them, it's a lot of the differentiation. What you're paying for is the ability to see into much, much lower light. Axis just came out with a new series of cameras for ultra low light that are just actually staggering. The demo film they have is of a train switching yard, which is normally just darn near no lights, dark enough that it's dangerous. And the video is of a guy with a single flashlight walking around the train yard just so he doesn't kill himself. And the light from that one flashlight is enough that it actually lit up the whole yard. We could actually see just like it was, say, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a really stunning video. and also the management pieces, you know, being able to manage multiple cameras. You know, it's easy to do one or two cameras. It's easy to do a webcam or two. But when you start talking about dozens, hundreds, thousands of cameras, in the case of things like the Las Vegas casinos, having that enterprise piece behind it really makes a big difference. University of Hawaii, we've got a lot of NetBots cameras slung all over our data centers, because that is there for both safety and security, and it's also combined with environmental monitoring. So there's lots of different flavors out there. It's pretty much down to, you know, how much are you willing to pay for the enterprise features, and how critical is that video to you?
Right. I was speaking with an Access representative at Interop New York, and what he was telling me was that they were impressed with the quality of some of these consumer level or maybe SOHO level cameras like DropCam. In fact, the DropCam is based off of an Access license design. But what they were saying is the difference between a consumer level and, say, an enterprise level is, well, if the consumer level camera goes off, you know that you have to reach over and you have to disconnect the power and reconnect it. In an enterprise solution, you don't expect these to tip over. Or if they tip over, you expect them to repair themselves, you know, get themselves back up and running, because they are mission critical. They're protecting vital pieces of your infrastructure or your actual physical campus. Now, do you see that? I mean, has that been your experience when dealing with consumer level cameras versus enterprise level cameras?
It's reliability. You know, little things like how durable is the camera? So I've got an Axis 214 PTZ 3 miles underwater, and it's actually it's right about 0 degrees Celsius. Try and put a cheap consumer-grade camera down there, and it's just not going to work.
Right.
In fact, the video that's up on the screen right now is the exact one that we have under the water. So it's kind of neat. It's all about durability, how long, how many, how often can that move around. There's a thing called a guard route that you can do on a lot of pan tilt zoom cameras. You can actually program the camera so that it will do a set of pan tilt zooms by, you know, poking little waypoints, and the camera will over time hit each of those waypoints to do like a guard route. That's something that you won't find in a consumer-grade camera, but you will in an enterprise-grade.
We've got a comment in the chat room saying, did you get a release from the fish that your camera is taking a look at? That's funny, but that's actually a legit question, and that is, if you're going to be setting up cameras in public areas, TWiT is a really good example. There are signs that as you enter, say, if you enter TWiT Studios, you will be on camera. There's not a question about that. But you can't do that everywhere. So what are the things you need to take into account when setting up cameras in a public area or a semi-public area?
A lot of it is posting. You've got to post warning that video surveillance is taking place. And I hesitate to go much further than that, because the rules and regulations are very different on private property than public property. And they're very different on a county-by-county basis. And you really have to check the laws. In the case of the University of Hawaii, I actually have to put a sign of a minimum size. So in my case, I have to put a sign that I think it's a minimum of 10 inches. You know, it has to be readable from a certain distance. The problem is that was only done by a couple of departments. The university itself has not made a ruling. In fact, most organizations really haven't put a whole lot of thought into this. And the privacy laws in most states are actually pretty vague on it, too. That's a real challenge, if you ask me.
Let's talk about actual infrastructure, because if we're going to be setting up cameras, we need to have the infrastructure to be able to support them. The DropCam is actually an excellent way to look at this, because, for example, I love the DropCams. These are really, really nice, but they only work with 2.4 gigahertz wireless, and they can be very intensive as far as the upload. You need a decent pipe to get it to the DVR, which is on the cloud. So if your infrastructure at your home or your small office or your small business office isn't up to it, then it's almost as if you don't have the cameras at all. I would assume it's the same thing for the enterprise cameras. You could put these all over your campus. You could have PoE switches. But if you don't have a decent enough infrastructure, your frame rate is going to suffer, and you may even have dropouts. Do you see any specific demands on your infrastructure when you're deploying enterprise-class cameras?
Oh, you bet. In a standard webcam from just about anywhere, Axis included, every time a person makes a connection to look at the video, that's a unicast stream. So say, for instance, we've managed to squeeze down the video, say, to an H.264 RTSP stream. That might be, say, 256 kilobits. Four people, that's a meg. Eight people, that's 2 meg. Just do the math. One of the things that we're doing, especially for the undersea observatory that everybody's asking me about, we can't afford that because the link between the AT&T cable landing site and the main UH Manoa campus is only 3 meg per second. That would very quickly get overwhelmed by just one group of school kids saying, "Ooh, look at the webcam underwater." All of a sudden, our entire link goes down, and now we have no bandwidth for data. So what we're doing is we're taking a single unicast stream, we're sending that back to our main campus where we've got nice big pipes, and from there it hits a real video server or Helix server, and that way we can handle thousands. This is exactly what the Dropcam people are doing. So most ISPs only give you at best 1 meg per second up, unless you're on a commercial account. You might have 10 down, but only one up. So that means you really can't have too many cameras going until your uplink's saturated. So these are some of the things that you got to really think about. The other problem with tilt, pan, and zoom is latency. If there's too much latency, people tend to start clicking on the control overly, and all of a sudden the camera's all the way over to the right on the stops because it's got, say, 10 commands all racked up just to move right. So you need to take a good hard look at maybe if you've got a lot of surveillance cameras, say for a warehouse or something, you might want to consider a slightly larger pipe, especially for your uplink.
Right. We have experience of this at Interop because we've used both something like the Axis network cameras and a drop cam. And I think the difference is actually very, very visible because the drop cam does need a big initial pipe. You need up to a meg if you're transmitting full HD to the Dropcam servers. But once it gets up there, all the traffic is handled on the Dropcam servers and there's no further demand from the local network. However, that happens regardless of if you're viewing the camera from the local side or from the internet. With the other cameras, with the Axis cameras, where we were storing our video feeds and our streams locally on a Netgear Ready NAS, there was only demands on the internal network, and our externals only had to feed out streams whenever someone hit the camera from the outside. So I think that's one of the things you have to also design into your network camera deployment, which is who's going to be looking at it. If it's purely just a security camera and you really don't want to buy a big pipe, then you get something like the Axis and you get a local server. If it's going to be for show, something like the Twit network, then it makes sense to use a service like Dropcam, which basically acts like CacheFly. It offloads the load from your connection. Or some sort of combination of the two, where you store security feeds on a local server and you stream some of them to an online in the cloud service. Chibert, any last words on deploying network cameras? Let's say you were talking to someone who is about to do a deployment. What kind of advice would you give to them? Cameras to look for, services to look for, features to look for, or just a general advice about how they create their deployment plan?
Well, one, if you're doing a small installation, I got to give a lot of credit to Axis. Their camera station software is actually very inexpensive, super easy to use, and it works great. For up to maybe 15, 20 cameras. If you're starting to talk about a lot more or you have a lot of legacy cameras that maybe some Panasonics, maybe some Mobotics, different other cameras, take a good hard look at the software from NetDVR. That's actually an interesting kind of halfway point. It's designed for security. It allows for local storage, local playback, local indexing. But in addition, it can cascade. In fact, the demo that they have up on their website starts off with a map of the United States, and you can click on whichever branch you want to go and still drill down until you get to an individual camera. It also has the ability that when you set, say, motion detect, it can actually automatically send up a, and it can automatically send an alert to a handheld device for your security people and show you the event on the camera. It's a pretty neat piece of software. It's not cheap, but it does scale very nicely, and it's pretty cool. You can also check out a magazine called IPVS, IP Video Surveillance. Yeah, I think so. I have paper copies, and I think they're still around, but that was a magazine dedicated only to IP-based webcams for video surveillance. It's there it is. Thank you, IPVS.
That's because RTD is magic.
Yeah, RTD is awesome. But yeah, it's a great magazine. I strongly suggest you grab a couple of copies if you're thinking about doing it. The tutorials and reviews that they do are actually really, really good. And I learned an awful lot about them. In fact, maybe what we should do is we should go and get those guys to get us a discount code. Ooh. Oh, I'll have to talk to them about that.
I'd use it, although I think there's a conflict of interest there. Cheebert, thank you very much. Network video is one of the things that both of us, well, we got into very early on. We got bitten by the bug. And, you know, it's actually becoming accessible even for the non-enterprise. So it's an important discussion to have, both in what we can do, how we should do it, and the legal ramifications. So this is not a dead topic. We're definitely going to circle around to it once more people get experience with deploying IP video systems.
Hey, maybe we should get Bill Shapiro to talk about it on the next show.
That's true. Although I don't think I can afford him anymore. I think I just tapped out our budget. Yes. Well, you know,
no bummer.
Good lawyers are expensive. I do want to take a moment, however, to talk about one of our sponsors, and that's SAP. Social Media Solutions from SAP is, well, it is like magic, because they have recognized that today it's all about your online branding, your online reputation. It's about what the blogger writes about your product line. It's about what gets put up on Facebook or Twitter or Pinterest. They understand that in order to protect your brand, you have to be engaged in social. The problem is, what happens when you are responsible for social media for a large enterprise? Well, it's not just that there's a huge volume of content that you have to go through. It's that you have to grade it. Does this person like our product? Does he kind of like our product? Is he making fun of our product? And then I need to route those messages to the right department within my enterprise in order to get it answered in a timely fashion. The businesses that respond well in the social are the businesses that do well. In other words, if you're not in the social media game, you're not playing. Now, Social Media Solutions from SAP has two components. The first is the listening component. It searches the social web in a way that it knows what's being said about your brand. But it doesn't just capture and regurgitate. It captures and reports on conversations about relevant terms, passions, and importantly, patterns and competitors. It surfaces sentiment and the intensity. So for example, do your customers like, love, or dislike something that you've just released? It also helps you build better products by incorporating real-time customer feedback into your innovation efforts. It helps you identify customers who are ready to buy based on buying signals that they're sending via social media. And it uses natural language processing to intelligently and automatically know the difference between similar statements like, this app has never been good, and this app has never been this good. It's that smart. Once you've got that listening component, you need to use the engaging component of their social media solutions. The engaging component is the second aspect of SAP's service. It helps you improve customer support by allowing you to set rules about which messages route to whom and how they should be dealt with. For example, if someone tweets a technical support problem, you can get it to the right person and fix their problem through social media in just a matter of minutes rather than days. SAP Social Media Solutions from SAP gives you an accurate and real-time understanding of your brand's social media performance, and that can mean all the difference. If you manage the social media presence for a large regional or national enterprise, we want you to get in touch with SAP. You can find out more at sap.com/twit, and we thank SAP for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. That's all the time we have for this episode. It blew right by. I do want to ask Chibert, is there anything that you need our listeners to know about? Any projects, anything that's interesting, fascinating, wonderful, or just, say, geeky in paradise?
Well, you know, I've been bragging about this video wall that I've had. I've just ordered the pieces for the next upgrade. I ordered a Kinect for Windows and an extra long USB cord. And one of the things that my geology types are using is they're teaching a class on Martian geology. And so they've got these massive, massive images, and they have to scroll around and zoom and so forth. It's been great. But how cool would it be to be able to do an air pinch or an air spread and be able to zoom around on that giant image just by waving your hands around? So that's one of the projects I'm going to start working on just as the parts arrive.
So can we get video of Chibert jumping around a huge video wall doing, you know, all the Kinect gestures? Because I'd pay money
Chibert
for that.
Olympic. It's Chibert aerobics, man.
Okay, so we've got the Chibert aerobics, but we've also got a few things that you, the listener, should know about. The first thing is that we are still gathering questions for our first Twiet question and answer episode. That's right. We are going to dedicate an entire show or two, depending on how many questions we get, to answering the questions that you have about the Enterprise. You can find it by going to twiet.reddit.com. Also, please subscribe. And we know that a lot of you are subscribing through iTunes. We thank you for that. That's fantastic. But if you go to our webpage at twit.tv/Twiet, you can find all the different ways that you can get Twiet and all the different formats. You can get an audio version for your car. You can get a high-definition version for your home. You can get the standard definition version if you want something to be able to watch on a mobile device on your way to work. We try to get it into the formats that you want to watch it in because we love you. Also, follow us on Twitter. That's my account at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to find out what the Digital Jesuit is doing. You'll be able to find out what's going on in future episodes. And you'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes of Twiet. Also, I want to make an impassioned plea here. If you're listening to this on a download, first of all, thank you very much. But did you know that we do this live? That's right. Every Monday at noon, right here in the Twiet studio, we have a major production of epic proportions to get this to you live. Live guests, live hosts, live TD, a live producer. Mostly. He might be sleeping. But it's one of the things that we here at Twiet believe in. This is not just a show. It's a community. That means that every Monday at noon, you can log into live.twit.tv, watch the show being taped live, and drop into irc.twit.tv and see all the geniuses, trolls, and collection of uber geeks and, just fantastic nerds that we've got in our chat room as part of the Twiet Army. I want to thank all the people who made this possible. First of all, our fantastic, magical producer, that's Jason Howell. Our producer, Carson, he's sort of our super producer. And people like Curtis B. in the chat room who makes the music for our video segments. I'm Father Robert. This is The Brick House. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiet.